It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti. And if you think a week on the beach might have calmed me down, then you obviously weren't at Stamford Bridge yesterday. But more of that later. Joining me to discuss this week in football are Ollie Kay, Alison Rudd, and of course, Julien Laurens. Later we'll be talking some Arsenal and whether we should pay any attention to the tales of woe emanating from there and from their AGM, or whether it's all just more of the same. But first, let's start with Chelsea and Manchester United. All right, now there's some, I think, very serious accusations, and this story is kind of breaking as we tape this podcast. But Chelsea have accused the referee Mark Clattenburg of using inappropriate language towards two of their players during the game yesterday. Obviously, a very heated game. Manchester United won 3-2. The two players in question, the reason this is so serious, well, beyond the obvious, are John Obi Mikel and Juan Mata. Now, Ollie, I'm going to start with you since you're normally better informed than everybody else on everything. I've seen reports that basically allege that Juan Mata was called a Spanish twat, and John Obi Mikel was allegedly called a monkey. Now, one thing I want to establish from you, do we know if this is in Chelsea's complaint, this specific language, or is it just the kind of thing that newspapers wrote because they were, quote-unquote, briefed on it by somebody on the know?
Do we know whether it's in the report?
No, not in the report, in Chelsea's complaint. I'm assuming in the report, Clattenburg didn't say yes. And then at one point, I turned to John Obi Mikel and said, "Hey, you monkey, come here."
There's a report submitted by a match delegate as well. And that report, I think, will contain the accusation, or maybe it would have some kind of extra sheet that would accompany the delegate's report, which would have the complaint on it. And I would think that there would be the specific words, and I'm told that the specific words which Chelsea's players believe they heard are the words you mentioned. It just seems baffling. I mean, in terms of where you go with this, obviously the referees are all mic'd up. Those conversations are not recorded. Maybe they should be. They're not broadcast live. Maybe they should be. But it's going to take some proper investigating this. And
Ollie, can I just ask? You're right. This proper investigation has to follow. We don't have all the facts, but two things seem pretty obvious to me. First and foremost, UEFA record the conversations between the mic'd up match officials. They record the conversations in Germany because they use it as a tool to help referees interact with each other and evaluate referees. Why on God's green earth don't they do it here? And should this be a learning opportunity where, you know, it makes sense to see what the referees and their assistants and the fourth officials are saying to each other during the game, right?
Yeah, well, I was told last night that was a FIFA rule that they are not recorded. If, you know, judging by what you're saying,
I suspect that you were flat out lied to, or the person you spoke to is ignorant, because I sat in a room with UEFA in at the end of August, and they played back recordings from the European Championships where you could hear referees and referees assistants and the assistant referees behind the goal line talking to each other. So obviously they taped them.
Aren't we being clever after the fact? Suddenly we have a situation where we would quite like to know what the officials said during a game. We never normally want to know. When they did mic up referees for the European Championships, how many, 4 years ago now, they did it for a movie called Referee. And it was an example of why you should not mic them up and record it, because all you could hear was swearing.
Right. I'm not talking about miking them up to make a movie or to release it to the public.
But if
referees and their assistants have to work together, then it probably makes sense if there's ways, even internally between the match assessors and stuff, when you can say, hey, you know, did you guys communicate here? You could have said this, you could have said that. It shows you how.
But you would have to trawl through over 90 minutes of screaming. Oh. That was the hilarious bit of the movie.
I don't think that's true. I mean, I think, or put it this way, certainly on the UEFA tapes, and maybe there's different technology, but at the Euros, the way the mics work, it's actually very, very clear. And it's actually very funny because the assistant for your pal, Howard Webb, he's basically doing a running commentary. And it's actually really interesting. He's like, okay, the ball's coming in, it's to your left, look out, Howard, he's got this kind of cross coming in. I thought it was very interesting. I'm sure it was helpful to Howard Webb. I just find it extraordinary that they don't do that. And hopefully that's something that we learn from it. And the other thing, before we move on from this, we need to give a shout out because it's our boss who wrote it, so it must be correct. FA, dear Football Association, dear Ollie's mate, Dave Bernstein, if you are going to go and do an investigation this time, I hope you won't. I hope it's all a big misunderstanding. Please, when you send Jenny Kennedy or her friend, Adam, to go and interview these people, and I feel like I'm the only person who's written this apart from Tony, make sure she carries recording equipment so when she takes witness statements, so that then there is no dispute about what's actually said, and you can actually go and do this properly and professionally. The other thing is, if you go and take witness statements from people, don't then lose the witness statement, or don't lose your notes, I should say, for 10 and a half months, which is what happened with Adam Senhai's notes when they went and they took Ashley Cole's deposition. I think that's fair to ask of the FA. Do you disagree, Ollie?
No, it seems if those things happen, then that those are particularly fair things to ask.
All right, now on to the game, which caused so much controversy. But before we get to the referees, which we'll no doubt circle back to it, Julien, I want to start with you. When we'd seen United in the last few games come out and play with sort of this front three of or a diamond, I guess, Rooney behind Van Persie and another striker, whether Welbeck or Chicharito Hernandez. And then in this game, he reverts to wingers. And I kind of thought that, all right, he's played with wingers for so long. He's got such good wingers. You know, this front three or this diamond's only going to be a temporary experiment. And I felt kind of vindicated when he moved back to the wingers. But it certainly worked extremely well in the first 45 minutes or so at Stamford Bridge, huh?
Yeah, but to be honest, I don't think it was really rocket science to go back to wingers, because clearly if you've watched Chelsea since the start of the season, their fullbacks are never protected by their offensive midfielders. I mean, Hazard on one side, Mata most of the time on the other side, never defend. They've never defended since the start of the season. That's why Chelsea's been conceded so many goals. So, you know, when Fergie signed his office and watched a few Chelsea games, said, okay, well, their weaknesses is clearly their fullbacks because they're never protected. So if I put back some wingers, you know, we would cause them problems. And yesterday, after like 2 minutes or even less than that, their fullbacks were in trouble because Hazard and Mata were not offering any sort of protection. And we saw Rafael going forward on the second goal, for example. Him and Valencia were 2v1 against Ashley Cole. And it happened again and again and again. It happened against Shakhtar as well for Chelsea in the Champions League. And I just thought that, you know, it was brilliant from Fergie, but I don't think it was really that difficult to find it before the game.
Ollie, if it wasn't rocket science from Fergie, should Di Matteo have taken countermeasures? Are there countermeasures he could have taken?
I think effectively the decision that Chelsea have taken this season, they don't have guys really who are going to give cover for the fullbacks. I think if you looked at Chelsea's squad, what would they have done yesterday? Would they have put another guy in central midfield? Would they have gone to 4-3-3? It's hard really to tell, because you're not really going to play Mata and Hazard to cover the fullbacks, as Julian.
You could have maybe asked them to stay wider and not go narrow as they sometimes did, and maybe by staying wide and up, you could have maybe pinned the fullbacks back a little bit.
Well, potentially, but you're not really going to persuade Raphael to stay back just by being there. I think it's the way that United attacked in numbers, broke with numbers, particularly down the right with Raphael and Valencia, and the fact that they gained such rewards from that so early in the game and went to 2-0, maybe that made it more sensible for them to retreat a little and aim to play on the counter-attack, and maybe that sort of enabled Chelsea to sort of work their way back into the game with Mata excellent. But I thought United did it really well, but I think looking at Chelsea's squad and looking at the fact that the lack of numbers in central midfield means that Ramirez is playing in that area rather than playing wide, I don't really see the alternatives for Dimas yesterday.
Alison, Manchester United, with all their experience, 2 goals up, Chelsea get back and they play it back to 2-2. Is it a case of placing blame on United for not being able to hang on to a 2-goal lead, albeit away from home? Or is it a case of praising Chelsea and their character for being able to get back to 2-2?
I think you have to praise Chelsea. I mean, strangely, although they lost, I think they were sort of irresistible at times. And they do have the ability to go behind, and then the sendings off, the whole feel of the game, they rose above it and they let their talent shine through. And some of their football was, given what was at stake in the game, was incredibly impressive.
I wanted to make it a point to talk about the football, as I thought it was a very good game. And I think it was one of, sometimes we mistake games with lots of goals because, oh, look, it's the crash bang wallop of the Premier League. And, but it's actually because people are defending badly and doing stupid things. In this game, I thought it was actually is two teams playing very, very well, and that's what led to the goals. But obviously, we have to talk about some of the officiating as well. And as you can see, I'd really, really rather not, but hey. I want to start with something. Obviously, the big talking point is Evans on Torres, and we're going to get into that, and also what Gary Neville said, which I thought was really indicative. But I want to start first with Torres on Cleverley, and whether, you know, he when he basically came and I think he struck him in the arm in the end, but it was a very high boot. That's the kind of thing you can see red for, isn't it, Julian? Should he have seen red?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think if Cleverley stays down a bit longer, than because he clearly got up straight away and shook Torres' hands like if nothing had happened, but it was like a kung fu kick, a bit like, you know, De Jong on Xabi Alonso in the World Cup final. It was very similar to that, not to the same extent because you know he didn't make that much contact with it. With him, but I think it was really, really orange type of card.
Yeah, I think we can kind of ditch the pro-United conspiracy theories here, because if there was one, it's pretty obvious Torres gave Clattenburg a very good reason to send him off there. I think it was just Clattenburg not having a very good day. And we'll get to the next point, which I think is an interesting one. Johnny Evans on Fernando Torres. Torres gets booked for diving. I don't think there's any question that there was contact. Sir Alex suggested afterwards, like, oh, there might have been contact, but why did Torres throw himself to the ground? Gary Neville, who I don't think can be accused of having an anti-Manchester United bias, he kind of, I'm going to quote him because he kind of sums up my view on this extremely well, which is that you have the central defender coming at you, going for the ball. You know he's going to make contact with you. Are you supposed to just kind of run into him to prove your point, to show that you're not diving? And I thought, yeah, he's exactly right. We've created this whole idea about diving and so on, and there has to be contact and whatever else. If you go in like that, if there will be contact, and in fact, in this case, actually was contact, I don't see how you can possibly construe that as a dive. Am I wrong, Arsenal? Alison, since you are the qualified referee among us?
No, but referees are under pressure at the moment. It's the big issue, isn't it?
Cut under out pressure diving.
Cut out diving. Well, they're briefed. They're briefed. They have big briefings monthly, and they're told what the issues are. This is what... I mean, managers lobby, and they say they don't like it. People like Tony Pulis, he's made it his bugbear of the season. It's the big thing at the moment, diving. Let's eradicate it. Let's look out for it.
Can I ask something on this point, though, right? I appreciate Tony Pulis, whose players generally do not dive. They simply handle the ball. sorry, Peter Crouch. He's making a big deal out of it. But at the same time, I look at who the biggest clubs in England are. Liverpool have Luis Suarez. Manchester United have Ashley Young and Danny Welbeck. Chelsea have Fernando Torres and Eden Hazard. It seems to me that actually the biggest clubs have the guys who most often get accused of diving. Why doesn't their voice and their sort of comments, why doesn't their voice count as much as Tony Pulis's voice on this diving debate? Is it really the clubs? Is it really Tony Pulis is driving it? Or is it we in the media who are driving this?
No, I'm just giving it as an example of how it's become the easy topic, if you like. You know, the default position after a game, if you don't want to talk about something about your club, let's talk about diving as an issue instead. David Moyes did it ahead of the Merseyside derby. Didn't want to talk about that Everton don't have any dosh. Thought he'd talk about diving, making people turn away from the game. So it's there, it's out there, it's an issue. Nobody, I don't think anyone would say, oh, I quite like diving, I'd want to keep it in football.
Roy Smith would, yes.
So you, in order to eradicate it, you have to be tougher on it than you might have been in the past, which means when you get grey areas, you, as a referee, you might take the view, you're not simply deciding was there contact or was there not contact. You're deciding, could the player have stayed on his feet easily? Did the player overreact? Did he embellish the fall? Is he trying to dupe me? And clearly in this case, Clattenburg thought Torres. And if you look at it in slow-mo, it does look kind of odd. It's only when you know for certain that there was contact. And we all know, if you're running and you're touched, you can sometimes fall down.
I'm sorry, but even if there was no contact, right? The referee, it's not like there's a rule that the referee has to either give a foul or book you for diving. The referee, there's also something called a not. The referee could either he could not sanction the foul and not book you for diving, right? It could be a non-call.
But they're making it a call because they want to flush it away. If you're going to have the wrong player sent off, he wasn't sent off for diving. But in the end, he was sent off effectively for diving. That will do wonders for making people, especially players who are just starting to come through into the Premier League, think I don't want to go there.
Ollie.
I really like the idea of zero tolerance on this. I like the idea of referees showing cards when there's any kind of theatrical tumble. You know, even when there's even when players have been clipped and then they sort of go on and then they throw themselves down and people say, oh, but there was contact. I like the idea of referees getting tough. And wiping this out and making a statement that says this kind of thing will not be tolerated. Obviously, it's a danger that English football stands alone in doing it, and there's a danger that it just becomes a sort of silly two-week fad rather than and then people back down again. But I like the idea. My problem with it is that the Torres incident yesterday, I don't think is one that merited a yellow card. I just don't see that he dived. I thought he got... he was fouled, and I don't think it was one where he reacted to the foul by suddenly throwing himself in an unnatural way. I don't think it's one where he stuck his leg out in a way that sort of instigated the contact either. I don't think that was a yellow card. I'm with Gary Neville on this one. I think there'll be perhaps half a dozen to a dozen incidents that are worse than that in every game, and I know people say, oh, but look at the way he throws his head back and so on. I do not think that was a dive.
But doesn't zero tolerance automatically mean there will be victims, that there will be the odd decision that's borderline?
That's why it's a stupid and demented policy, and only sort of populist policemen or mayors and morons like that come out and talk, zero tolerance! Yeah, it's a question. You're zero tolerance of diving, which means zero tolerance of cheating. That's fine. In this case, he didn't cheat.
No, exactly.
I mean, he was, as Ollie says, he was hit on the leg. And I'll tell you what, even if he wasn't hit, what is he supposed to do? Julian, help me out here. And I appreciate, you will probably fall on the side of the divers because you're French and, you know, you're Thierry Henry and all this stuff. But goodness me, the tackle's coming in. Why do you have to run into the guy's foot?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Anyone who's played the game,
and you've played at a higher level than the rest of us.
But at that pace, if there's a slight contact, and that was more than a slight contact, there's no other choice for Torres to go down. You know, even if he hadn't been touched by Evans, just the tackle itself at that pace would have unbalanced Torres completely, I think.
Oh, but how do we know he had no choice? You see, Ferguson said, did he choose to go down?
Yeah, but because Fergie said then, oh, when I was a striker, you know, I would have stayed on my feet. Yeah, but 50 years ago, it was not that pace. And to be fair, Fergie never ran as fast as Fernando Torres anyway, even 50 years ago. But it's a bit the same for Clattenburg then. He was not sure 100% that there was no contact. So, you know, it's a bit like the offside. You've got the benefit of the doubt. You know, if he was not sure if there was contact or not, don't give a yellow card.
But in the long run, it'll make players think twice about overdoing it or choosing to go down when they have a choice not to.
But next time Torres would be in the same position, he'd be touched as well. There'd be a foul on him. He would go down because at that pace, I don't think he had the choice to go down or not.
I propose a resolution to this, seizing upon Ollie's idea. I think we need to use a little bit of moral suasion. What I would like, and this could be the FA or a could be the media, perhaps one of those, and Sky have a lot of hours to fill. Why don't we pick out the 10 incidents of theatrics? I'm not talking about diving. I'm talking about theatrics post-tackle, right? And we all know what we're talking about. I think Ollie referred to it. And just play them and be like, hey, Mr. X, Y, or Z, please cut this out. You look like a fool. Yes, you were fouled, but there's no need to roll around like an absolute moron. Or like, oh, look, you were touched on the ankle, but you go down grabbing your knee, right? Yeah. I think Thomas Vermaelen had a bit of that as well. You know, and just name and shame. And maybe that's one way that we can cut this out without cards and suspensions and punishments.
The other way to cut it out, though, is
to book everybody.
No,
book them constantly.
No, seriously, is for referees to start giving free kicks when players don't go down. When a player tries to stay on his feet,
you mean referees applying the rules?
An advantage doesn't work.
But you're talking about referees applying the rules of the game and showing backbone and personality.
No, because we are letting the game flow, and a lot of players would say to you, "Well, I have to fall over, otherwise I'm not going to get the free kick."
Well, I mean, I think there's some referees here in England who actually do a very good job of that, and who have the courage to go and apply the rules even when the player doesn't go down. Unfortunately, there are others who, maybe because they're worried about what their assessor will say, don't do that. But I think that's a great point that Allison makes. We have to talk about one more point before we move on to the derby, which is, of course, United's winning goal. Now, linesmen are going to take a lot of stick on this program. This is a very bad weekend for linesmen. I'm not going to put this on Clattenburg. Not just in England, by the way. Anybody who saw the Juventus game will attest to. But Chicharito Hernandez ends up in the goal, right? I'm the linesman. I'm the referee, looking across, right? The guy is in the goal. So I know that he's going to do one of two things. He's either going to stay in the goal, right? In which case, he's off the pitch and I don't care about him. Or he's going to attempt to come back into play, which is exactly what he did.
Yep.
How can I not be aware? How can I not notice that this guy is offside?
I suspect the error was made not in forgetting he was in the back of the net and he might come back into play, but it was that he was level with Cech and the linesman just forgot that there had to be someone else there too. I'm trying to explain it because it is rather hard one to explain. I agree.
I respect Alison's
I'm
great attempt to help the
well, how else could you explain it?
Because he's rubbish. Completely rubbish, and he's got nothing to do in the game anymore, and I hope he never referees any game. I just cannot see it. I promise you, Alison, I just cannot see it.
Whoever was the assistant, not Clattenburg.
You can't blame Clattenburg for this one.
No, the assistant.
And I don't even think that was the worst. I think there's worse to come this weekend. There's worse to come, in my opinion.
I've seen linesmen have terrible, terrible games where they go through a sort of 10-minute patch and get every offside wrong and get every throw-in wrong. And it didn't seem to be one of those. It seemed to be one very, very bad decision. But as you suggested, there was a worse decision by linesmen this weekend. I think you mean the Arteta one. I thought that was even worse.
Now, in the interest of fairness, my Manchester United supporting friends told me that this is some huge karmic thing because, of course, Chelsea won a title when Drogba scored an offside goal against Manchester United. And so, in the end, everything balances itself out. Don't believe that for one second that things balance themselves out, but it is true. Drogba was offside.
Now let's move on to the derby, the only derby that matters, the friendly derby, Everton and Liverpool. Alison, you're the Liverpool fan here. 2-0 up after 20 minutes. What were you thinking?
You don't draw conclusions from the derby game, for a start. All right, you're asking me as a Liverpool fan as opposed to someone who writes for the Times. I've yet to be convinced by Rodgers and his team selection and this halo he seems to have with the words youth written on it, and I think the proof of that came because he should have won the game, because the goal at the end was valid and that would have been fine. But if he'd got there and won the game, it would have been because he ditched the youth policy and brought on
what, Shelvey and Quetta?
Those very
he brought them on because they were more disciplined and
a tiny bit older than Cesar.
Tiny bit older and more experienced.
All right, Luis Suarez goes and celebrates by taking his goal by taking that dive in front of David Moyes. Was this funny, all in good fun, or disrespectful? Anybody want to go and be sort of horrid and grumpy and say it was disrespectful or anything other than good fun?
Let's be honest, it's not going to win any comedy awards, but it's not, nor is it exactly some kind of incitement or great outrageous celebration of cheating. It's a bit of fun, just not all that funny.
I bet you Rory Smith saw it as absolutely hilarious and a wonderful celebration of the dark arts of simulation. Julian, the dark side of Suarez.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Suarez on this stand. Now, it looked to me like at first he was just looking to trip him up, but in the end, it's pretty nasty.
Yeah.
Should he have gone?
I mean, I agree with you. Initially, I didn't think it was on purpose. And then when you watch the replay, and Suarez is a player that I absolutely love, it did look like he did it on purpose, to be fair. The way he caught the Achilles of Distan, and just the way where the ball was and where he was initially and then where Distan was, it looked like he did it on purpose. And, you know, in that case, it could have been red, definitely. It's a bit like the Torres cleverly incident initially, except that this one looked far from the ball and he was clearly not playing the ball. He was just walking on an opposition player. I thought it was really bad, to be fair, really.
Before we get to the end, let's a word on Everton, because Marouane Fellaini's coming back from injury. I thought he's not, he wasn't 100%, but I thought he did his job well as an Osman in the middle of the park. As did Phil Neville, who of course took a dive as well and then joked about it afterwards and admitted it and said he got a rollicking from David Moyes. The thing is, would he have admitted it if he'd not been caught?
He probably wouldn't have admitted it if he'd won a penalty, but maybe with it being a derby, he would have taken greater satisfaction in admitting it. But I thought Everton played. I thought Everton's response to going 2-0 down was fantastic. I mean, you expect to see a great deal of fight from Everton in any game, really. But I mean, I think we've seen them in derby matches down the years occasionally lose their heads, and although there were a few robust challenges and tackles flying and so on, I thought their overall approach when they had the ball yesterday was brilliant. After they went 2-0 down, I thought they looked the more likely winners for about half an hour after their first goal, never mind the second goal, and then Liverpool sort of came back into it towards the end, and I thought both teams showed what they were. Yes, I think Liverpool showed encouraging signs in transition, and Everton showed that they are a team who probably more than Liverpool this year look equipped to challenge the sort of top 4, 5, 6.
You really believe that?
I do believe it. I think Liverpool.
No, not do you believe that? Are they better equipped than Liverpool? But do you really believe they can challenge for top 4, 5, 6?
I do. I don't think they'll finish in the top four, but I think they'll be.
In the top 10.
I think they'll be in the top 6, and I think they'll be closer to the top 4 than in the years when the top 4 seemed to be a closed shop. And as for Liverpool, I think they I think I'm more convinced by Rodgers than Alisson is than Julian is. I think I like everything he does, but I think they are a team in transition. They're a thin squad, inexperienced squad in many departments, and I think it's asking an awful lot to turn them into a top four team.
Just one thing on Everton. Great first half from Miralas.
Yes.
By the way, who looked really promising yesterday. Then he got injured and had to be substituted at halftime. But you know, he came. You know, I mean, no one really talked about him. You know, he was quite cheap. You know, and it's another great finding, I think, from Moyes. I mean, some people knew about him before, but you know,
you go back 4 years and you read my column about how Belgium will win or could be among the contenders for the 2014 World Cup.
And I agree.
Then you will notice that I was flagging up Morales back when he was a lot younger. Morales,
and he came for France, so obviously I agree with you on that one. But
so
no, yet
I might have had some inkling about him. All right, finally, let's talk about. We thought there was a winner from Luis Suarez. It was disallowed. Alisson, since I'm feeling generous, I can give the linesman the benefit of the doubt that maybe he started waving his flag because he saw Coates foul Chigelka, but in reality, that's probably not why he struck it off. He struck it off because he thought Suarez was offside, right?
Yes, and he wasn't.
Another mistake.
But as we are doing the list today, where does that come? Probably fifth. it was more forgivable than some decisions over the weekend because he was level-ish.
Ollie, you're neutral on this issue. Are you ready to forgive because he was level-ish?
I think it was as incompetent as the other decisions. If he, the Arteta one and the Hernandez one. If he gave it for offside, if he gave it for a foul by Quattes, then I think he's got more of a case. But I don't think it was a good decision. It was, it probably saved there being a riot at the end.
Why did it take so long for the linesman to put the flag up? It took him ages. The ball was already in the net for like a few good seconds before he put the flag up. It's either you know or you don't know. If you don't know, just don't put the flag up. If you're not sure, again, we come back to like you have to be sure 100% that he was offside too. Otherwise, there's the benefit of that. But why did you take him so long?
I think it's fair enough not to expect the flag to go up immediately, because once you've put it up, you've put it up. You are allowed, and you should be encouraged as an official, to process the information. It seems like a long time, but it's not really. You are almost doing a little playback in your head. Yeah, I saw where the free kick was taken, and I'm pretty sure he'd strayed offside as it was struck, aren't I? Aren't I sure about that? Yes, I am. Now I'll put my flag up.
I wonder if these 2 points dropped are the 2 points that relegate Liverpool. Yeah, see that bitter laugh? But inside she's like cursing me for jinxing him. She's not the only one. All right, bumpy AGM last week for the Arsenal. It's an age-old situation. I think the club's a bit of an enigma. We're going to talk a bit about what's happening on the pitch, but what's happening behind us, because you have a club with a stadium that generates money. You have a club that's financial fair play compliant. You have a club that has all these really bad commercial deals that are all expiring, I think, in 2014. It's actually kind of funny. Arsenal's commercial revenue last year, I think it was something like about half, or slightly more than half that of Schalke 04 from Gelsenkirchen, which I think is absolutely appalling. But all those bad commercial deals are coming to an end, so they've got this big windfall coming down the road. But at the same time, this is a team that loses its best players every year. Ollie, care to explain?
If you go back, whatever it was, 10 years to where they announced the move to Ashburton Grove, as it was always called in very grand terms at that time. The idea was that they would be able to compete with the biggest clubs in Europe and compete financially as well as compete on the pitch. And if you look at how things have gone in 6 years at the Emirates, I think they've looked more than ever like a club that has to sell. And that has got to be extremely worrying for Arsenal fans, and I know they are worried by it and vexed by it, but at the same time, you look at the results. I mean, obviously the trophies is one thing, but you look at the fact that they have remained a top three team in the Premier League throughout that time while spending less than their rivals. They've they've consistently been sort of quarterfinals, semi-finals of the Champions League, or at very least last 16. There is an awful lot to admire. There's an awful lot to say it's working. But whereas they have been able to compete with the very best, they keep losing players, and I think their wage structure really is one of the big things that holds them back.
Whenever we discuss Arsenal, I always think the big question is, if for some reason Wenger decided to walk away and they brought in a manager who said all the right things at interview, but once he was in the job said, I need money to buy that top player, that top player, that top player, and I don't care how much the salaries are, I want them, I want them, I want them, would the Arsenal board, as they intimated at the AGM, give the money?
Sure. By the way, is there really such a thing as an Arsenal board, or is it just Stan Kroenke?
There's a board.
Okay, but didn't Stan Kroenke own like 2/3 of the club, and ultimately he decides?
Well, he has a large say, but I mean they've got Usmanov who owns a third of the club, and it's a fairly difficult.
He's very well represented on the board, isn't he?
Well, exactly, but things. I mean, he could in theory make life very difficult for the board if they're doing things he doesn't want them to do, and I mean he's obviously spoken out at times of political expediency, like when Van Persie issued his statement in July, but I don't think it's just Stan Kroenke. I mean, Ivan Gazidis is a more empowered chief executive than right. Some of them are around.
But I mean, Ivan Gazidis is employed by Stan Kroenke. Kroenke gives him goals, right? He says, run the club, maximize profits, finish in the top four, do this and that.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I presume so. It's like Gazidis pretends, oh, I own this club. And I don't think it's Gazidis' goal in life to go and not spend money just to help Kroenke make more money. He follows instructions. He's an employee, right?
Yeah, but in the same way, I think David Gill follows instructions. I mean, David Gill is seen as a powerful chief executive, but he operates under sort of tight parameters that are forced on him by ownership.
So it comes from the owner. I mean, Julian, can you explain to me why they have they have all these money in cash reserves, but most of all, they have a very wealthy owner, in fact, two wealthy owners, who. If they, for example, if they wanted to snap their fingers and make the liability on the stadium go away, they could do that overnight, couldn't they?
Yeah.
It's not just Kroenke, who's extremely wealthy. He's married to somebody who's a lot wealthier than he is. I mean, who's in the Abramovich sphere, if not the Mansour sphere. They could do this, and they could do it and still be financial fair play compliant. Why don't they do this?
I think it's Wenger's policy.
But Wenger doesn't want Kroenke to go and pay off the stadium.
No. I think in terms of spending money, I don't think the stadium was.
So it's Wenger who chooses not to spend money.
Yeah, I think if Wenger can have Falcao for 10 million quid tomorrow, he will buy him. If he can sign Falcao for 50, he won't.
Right.
Because he's never done it before.
So if a new manager came in and said, "I want to spend that 50 million on one player," do you think Stan and the board would say, yeah, sure,
I believe Gazidis would be in favour, yeah. I think there might be a bit of convincing to do with Kroenke, but I definitely think that, you know, the wage structure at the moment was established by Wenger for many, many years now, and he doesn't want it to change.
Well, no, on the wage structure, Julian, and obviously you've got good special insight on the club, one mystery to me is the way it's been explained to me by agents and others. You have a situation where the top players, or rather, the difference in wages earned by the top players and the squad players, people like your pal Johan Giroud, for example, isn't that great, or Sebastian Squillaci, or people like that. So you've got guys who never play, who maybe make 30 or 40 grand less than people who are integral to the team, like Arteta or Vermaelen or whatever. And that's very different from other clubs where reserves get paid like reserves and superstars get paid like superstars. Is that the case? Yeah. And what's the logic behind it?
That's I think, the big problem, in my opinion. The wage bill at Arsenal is almost the same as at United. And at United, you've got players like Rooney on 250k a week, with the highest salary at Arsenal, I believe, is around 110 maximum, 120 maybe.
Is this some kind of Wenger socialist utopia?
I think it's just that Wenger was very generous for some, like, reserve player, like you said, someone like Schillaci or Giroud, you know, Bentner in his time and things like that. And I think that's what is unbalancing everything else. Just because Wenger, in his mind, doesn't want to do too many differences between his players. So you could be the big star and you could be the guy who we see on the bench most weeks, but he doesn't want it to be too different in terms of wages. That's his idea, and I think he will die with his, you know, with his ideas.
Ollie, this seems stupid to me and out of touch with the rest of the world. I've got two questions for you. Was it like this when David Dean was there? And secondly, shouldn't the strong chief executive, Ivan Gazidis, do something about this? Or does Wenger really get to decide everything, including how much people get paid?
I'm just testing my mind back to when David Dean was there. I mean, would they have been able to attract people like Bergkamp and Platt and Henry and others without shattering their wage structure? And I don't think they would have done. And don't forget that they paid a huge wage to get Sol Campbell on a free. I think he was the highest paid player in English football for a while. Sol Campbell in, when was it, 2001, when he went there. It hasn't always been the case. It's not something Wenger has always done, but I think it's it is a very strange thing, because it's an inability to attract and retain real A-list players.
Ollie, I don't know if you missed what Julian said, but it's not so much at the top end; it's at the bottom end.
I know, but if you're giving a guy like Giroud or Diaby or whoever far more than they merit, then that effect, that means that a lot of your wage budget is going on players that could be paid a lot less, and that means that, you know, the ones at the top end, there's less money for, especially when it's been regulated quite tightly. And Arsenal do not pay the kind of figures that Manchester United were paying, 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago. It's ridiculous to think that, I don't know precisely how much they were willing to pay Van Persie to stay, but it's an awful lot less than he would have got offered at Man United or Man City or Chelsea, 3, 4 years ago, never mind now. And I think now that the increased TV money that will be coming in, players' wage demands are going to go up and up and up. And obviously we can say that is unhealthy. We can say that, good on a club like Arsenal for standing up against it. But in order to be competitive, they need as many of these very good players as they can get their hands on, or at least keep once they've got their hands on them. Like Cazorla. I mean, what's Cazorla's next contract going to be? Is he going to want more money? You would imagine he will, and Arsenal have to be willing to pay what it takes to keep him.
But as a fan, should you be angry that your club doesn't want to give Robin Van Persie 300k a week? As a fan, would you really be angry and think, oh, we should have given him 300k a week?
If the money's there, Arsenal generate a tremendous amount of money. They could generate even more money, and they will generate more money in the future. What I find frustrating, and you've got this owner who could improve the situation even more, for example, by putting money into the stadium and paying off the mortgage so that you've got more money available. In the end, it comes down to, is Arsenal a giant cash machine and you just sit there and let its value appreciate over time, or do you actually want Arsenal to be successful? Nobody's suggesting that they need to go into debt. Nobody's suggesting they need to do what a Mansour Abramovich does, but I don't know. I kind of feel like Arsenal could easily run at proper break even, not sort of fictional with money moving around, and probably have retained better stars. But we should give Alison the last word on this and ask a very simple question. Who has a brighter future, Alison? Which red-clad team? Is it Arsenal or Liverpool? And why?
In the short term, Arsenal. Yeah.
In the long term?
Arsenal.
There you go. Time now for some quick hits. Stoke and Sunderland play out a hard-fought 0-0 draw, but Alison, I was struck by the officiating in this game, maintaining our theme throughout the show. We should also give a shout-out to our friends, the Aston Villa supporters, very angry about the officiating in their game, too. It seems that Mark Halsey allowed plenty of tasty challenges, which might otherwise have been punished with yellows, if not reds. Tony Pulis, unsurprisingly, didn't mind. You're the only qualified ref here. Are you okay with this type of common-sense officiating in every game stands alone, or should there be consistency throughout games rather than within games, if you see what I mean?
Well, I think it's hard enough to get consistency within games. So that's your first port of call as a referee, and that should be what you try and do, is make sure across the 90 minutes you are consistent within that, and you are, as a referee, encouraged to embrace the atmosphere, the mood, the type of game it is. You do referee differently if you're refereeing under nines or veterans. It's the way it is. Once you've established that you can do it within 90 minutes, then it would be wonderful if you could be consistent across the whole Premier League, but it's a pipe dream, probably.
Manchester City pull out a 1-0 win over Swansea, which I guess is good for Mancini, but it's hardly an impressive performance until, of course, the god of football, Mario Balotelli, comes on in the second half to save the day. Ollie, does it all matter at this stage, or should City just kind of be happy they're getting results and sooner or later the performances will come as well?
Well, there are two layers to this. One is the result, where they are on the table. They're only 1 point off the top. They've dropped 6 points all season. They've got more points from the equivalent games than they did last season. But the bigger concern for Mancini is the sort of prevailing mood at City. And I'm not talking about the fans. I'm not even talking so much about the players. But there's a lot of tension behind the scenes. James Ducker covers it at great length in today's Times, confirming a lot of what I've heard as well. I know Manchester City fans think that there's some kind of conspiracy against Mancini and so on. I would advise them to read that, what James has written, and they'll probably learn that the situation is not a terribly healthy one at the moment.
Well, I know Mancini feels that it's not really paranoia when everybody's out to get you.
No, exactly.
But he's normally so level-headed. But anyway, Mark Hughes will likely be in trouble for saying the referee gave him some, quote, cock and bull, unquote, story about Ryan Nelson being off the pitch and playing Mikel Arteta onside when Arsenal scored their winner against QPR. Alison, I can confirm that if Hughes is right, it is a cock and bull story because Nelson is actually a big man and is pretty hard to miss. And he was clearly not off the pitch as the voice of all referees. Do you have sympathy for Sparky?
Well, obviously a bit. He's in big trouble. He might not be in a job this time next week. But in this case, the referee is relying on what his assistant tells him. He's not making up a story.
He is, if he's saying that Ryan Nelson's off the pitch when in fact he isn't.
Well, you know,
somebody's making it up.
No, in this instance, it will be his assistant who says, this is why I gave the decision. And I think, give not just this question, but the whole of the podcast implies that perhaps we shouldn't be focusing so much on the referee, but maybe the quality of assistant referees. At the moment, you decide quite early in your officiating career, I'm going to go down the path of being an assistant. And I think you have to ask, why would you make that choice?
So much for the doubters, Julian. Jack Wilshere is back. And I thought he was a figment of my imagination. And he actually looked pretty good in an otherwise ho-hum Arsenal side that beat QPR 1-0. Julian, can he single-handedly save Wenger's season?
It's not that he can, it's that he will, and he is already the saviour. He was awesome on Saturday. I thought the way he took control of that game, he's very talented, he's going to get stronger and stronger, fitter and fitter, and he would definitely be the saviour.
Julian Lawrence, a true believer! Tottenham Hotspur win at Southampton, and there are rumours that Nigel Atkins' job is in jeopardy. Ollie, you love sacking managers, don't you? Is it time for Atkins to go before the situation gets out of hand, or is he being treated somewhat unfairly?
I think you've got the wrong guy. I hate sacking managers.
You love it. You're a child of Thatcher, remember?
Right. I especially hate sacking managers whose crime would be to over-deliver in delivering promotion the previous season. I think Southampton have got a great long-term plan. I think Atkins and the way he manages it is a great part of that. I'm trusting with young players. And if they were to sack him and get a more short-termist manager in, I think they'd regret it.
Yes, some of us are on message when it comes to Atkins, and I count myself among them.
Good.
Let's end on a happy note after all this negativity. Reading and Fulham battled to a 3-3 draw, and we saw some absolutely unbelievable goals. I'm not being sarcastic. It really did brighten my day. Julian, my personal favorite was Brian Ruiz's, especially since I was telling everybody how good he was going to be, and it took him sort of forever to get going. But he certainly wasn't the only special one. Who do you want to big up?
I would have picked Ruiz as well, because I love the build-up and I love the player, and I thought it was a great finish. I would go for Berbatov, though, because he was grumpy the whole game, and just at the 80th minute, or 85th minute, or something like that, just popped up and scored a great goal, you know, from from the inside of the box with his rifle, and I just, it shows how brilliant he is and how grumpy he is, and I just love that about him. So I would go for Berber. Gab, one for you. Forget the Clásico between Barcelona and Real Madrid. On Sunday we had the Super Clásico between Boca and River Plate. How did it go and why was it so important?
Well, Julien, it was so important because obviously it was the first Clásico since River Plate's relegation. Of course, they've come back up under Matias Almeida, and it lived up to the billing. I mean, I think this is my favorite derby in the world, possibly the most intense derby after the Old Firm. And you know, you had the Monumental, and it's strewn with paper, and they rip up the newspapers and everything, and River Plate take the lead, and then in the first half, and then they made it 2-0, everything going swimmingly, and the Boca manager Falcioni, I mean, he looks like this weird cartoon character, grumpy, defensive, and yet they claw one back with a slightly, actually, it wasn't a dodgy penalty, I kicked them almost out of the stadium to make a 2-1, and then they score in injury time, and River are gutted, and Boca celebrate, and there was a giant inflatable pig in Boca colors. This is colorful, this is a carnival atmosphere, this is fantastic. I wish the Argentine League were marketed better, and simply we saw more of it, because it's some of the most entertaining football in the world, in my opinion. That's all we've got time for this week. It's been fun and it's been real. You can find us on Twitter. We're all on there. Ollie's on there with his 10 bazillion followers. Julien, you're on there too, right? What's your Twitter handle?
Lawrence Julien.
Lawrence Julien. There you go. Share your thoughts with us. You can also email us at gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. You can remember, of course, go to our website, thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis. You can also read our blogs, which are actually free for non-subscribers, just like this podcast. They'll be free for an hour or so, but look on the website, you'll get your token. Some of the stuff is very, very good. My favorite blogger, apart from Ollie, of course, is George Culkin. Actually, I rank myself ahead of George, too. So maybe, apart from Ollie and myself, it's George Culkin. But there's lots of good stuff on there, even if you're not a subscriber. Till next time, bye-bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.